Hey there, everyone. Welcome back to The Forum, where science comes to socialize. I'm Daniela, and I'm pretty excited about today's episode, mainly because its big picture theme will make it sound a little bit familiar to Forum regulars, for a few different reasons. First of all, my two colleagues, Aubrey and Cleo, are, as usual, here with me.
Hey, guys.
And don't forget about Callie. I know you're personally intimidated by her, Daniela, after she stared you down that one time in college, but let's not forget our favorite ISGP pet.
Right. That's Cleo, if you couldn't tell. Always putting her cat before herself.
I mean, you can't blame me. She's perfect, so.
She is pretty cute. I'll give you that. I'm not even a cat person. Anyway, I'm a little nervous now that you've mentioned that this episode will be familiar, Daniela. I don't want us to be a broken record or anything.
Oh, no. That's not what I meant at all. It's familiar, but not anywhere near the same.
Okay, so why is this episode going to be familiar then?
Well, do you remember that one time you and I got into that emotion versus analytics debate right here on the air for the whole world to hear?
Of course I do. Mostly because, you know, I won.
Right. We'll just call it a tie and continue.
I don't think so. And by the way, if you're listening right now and have no idea what we're talking about, be sure to go back and check out episode 66, in which we assess the pros and cons of emotional and analytical approaches to perceiving / responding to risk. You'll get all the proof there that you need that, once again, I was the winner in that debate.
Okay, you two can knock it off. Daniela, what does this episode have to do with?
Okay, so this episode also speaks to the topic of risk, but more related to food. It's based on a policy position paper debated at the 2014 ISGP conference called Food Safety, Security, and Defense, Focus on Food and the Environment.
Oh, I do remember this one. Titled, Zero Tolerance is a Bad Strategy to Protect Food Safety. The paper was written by Dr. Don Steckel, who at the time was the principal research scientist at Battelle Memorial Institute, but now works as a regional extension associate for Cornell University.
Essentially, Dr. Steckel argues that when making regulations, particularly involving food, government agencies are often really unwilling to accept any negative outcomes, like illness, as acceptable possibilities for citizens and consumers.
Which doesn't seem at all like a bad idea to me.
You've got a point, Cleo, and that's why what Aubrey just said is true about regulators' willingness. However, avoiding risk altogether, basically saying that a little bit of risk is never acceptable at all, can actually be counterproductive to public health. Dr. Steckel explains that the development of acceptable risk levels, particularly in the context of food safety, is super important from both a practical and public health standpoint.
Actually, there was widespread agreement during this debate that, wait a second, are you ready for this one? Because it's really the bread and butter of today's entire conversation. Okay, here it is. Zero tolerance risk frameworks for food contamination, or safety regulations in general, are not normally scientifically based, nor are they even practically achievable.
That's right, folks. It's impossible to ensure that food is 152% perfectly free of any contamination by any microbe or bug or whatever.
It's just fact.
Yeah.
Instead of a zero-tolerance framework, a risk-based framework is way more appropriate for defining regulations and policies about food safety, or, again, other safety threats. During the debate of Dr. Steckel's paper, risk itself was proposed as a common currency or common denominator that everyone can more or less understand, thereby standardizing analysis and guiding actions within the food system.
And when you say everyone can understand risk, of course you mean that people have a common desire to minimize things like, I don't know, people getting sick from the food they eat.
Yeah, exactly.
And as you've probably heard us argue in past episodes, policy decisions are often disconnected from rigorous scientific understanding, striving for safety ideals that simply aren't justified by risk analysis and statistics. And while we all know how I feel about the importance of validating emotion,
again, episode 66 for reference, y'all.
Right. So while we all know how I feel about this, there are certainly issues associated with the fact that many legislative efforts are driven by emotional and social considerations that have a gut feeling vibe about them.
And what Daniela means is this. Current regulations under the United States Food Safety Modernization Act, or FSMA, you might have heard us refer to previously on the show, which was enacted in 2011, make up a one-size-fits-all approach to instituting food standards. And this is concerning for several reasons. One, which I know Cleo is pretty passionate about, is that some stakeholders, such as large-scale growers, are easily able to bear the costs to meet regulations, while, on the other hand, small-scale growers are potentially forced out of the market.
Ugh, you're right. That is literally a pet peeve of mine.
Okay, no, a pet peeve is, I don't know, hating the sound of vacuum cleaners. That's mine anyway.
Are you a dog?
Okay, the point is that this is not a pet peeve. It's a personal problem with a deep-rooted societal norm.
Which I feel the need to personally fix. Yes, I failed to see your point. Anyway, this pet peeve issue of mine exemplifies the trade-offs between demanding super high, perhaps unreasonably high, levels of safety and allowing for vibrant local food systems.
This sort of regulatory approach promotes a centralized food system, impeding regionalization and giving large corporations a competitive advantage.
In particular, small-scale farmers, like the ones I worked with.
And we made it a full 3 minutes before she mentions her farm work, everyone. That is a record here on the forum.
Ouch. Hey, I'm not always talking about my farm work. Am I? Well, anyway, it's not my fault if we're always talking about food, or that I think small-scale food production is the answer to literally everything. But anyway, as I was saying, small-scale farmers anywhere often can't afford to hire professional safety experts to assure compliance with complex regulations.
And in that light, debaters agreed that implementing specific numeric targets for risks, such as the number of microbes allowed in a particular food, would improve market competition, because you could theoretically be able to meet that target in a variety of ways, depending, of course, on what method seems most appropriate for your particular food production facility.
Scale-appropriate regulations are a related critical issue with FSMA. Despite efforts to create science-based food safety regulations, FSMA is generally scale-insensitive, demanding the same level of risk regardless of a farm's production and distribution level.
Yeah, but the issue is that statistical calculations or modeling approaches may not exist for determining appropriate risk levels for multiple distribution sizes. I mean, come on, how do you compare roadside vegetable stands with farmers markets or national distribution centers?
I have a way. Buy all your food from farm stands and boycott the food department stores of the world.
What is a food department store?
You know, like chain grocery stores that sell everything and stuff. I hate them, obviously.
Okay, those are not department stores. And stop telling us how to live our food-related lives, Cleo. Anyway, since we can't really model appropriate levels of risk for Cleo's food faves versus foes, instead, FSMA exceptions such as the Tester-Hagen Amendment have been enacted to exempt growers based on production size, rather than risk level. Such size-based exemptions have been applied to community-supported agriculture, or CSA, organizations.
Which are...
Oh, they're just partnerships between farmers and consumers in which the responsibilities and risks and rewards of the farming are actually shared.
Come on, Dee, you should definitely know this. I'm sure they have them all over the UK.
Oh, they totally do. CSAs actually exist all over the world.
Okay, so CSAs are exempt from FSMA, which speaks to US policy. But what about in broader policy? Are there any worldwide guidelines for assessing food risk?
Actually, yeah. The World Health Organization, or the WHO, adopted a risk-based framework for assessing food safety when developing its international health regulations.
It turns out that, in this case here, the WHO totally agrees with our debaters, arguing that a zero-tolerance approach creates critical knowledge gaps.
A challenge that was raised against the risk framework proposal is that it does not account for the health benefits associated with consuming foods like fresh fruits and vegetables. Some debaters thought that the benefits would need to be incorporated into a full picture of risk. What we mean by this is that fruits and vegetables can be contaminated, like all other foods, sure, but they're also fundamentally good for you. I guess what I mean here is that Doritos can be contaminated too, but sorry y'all, they're just not good for you. I don't care how much you like them, Aubrey.
Literally one of my biggest weaknesses, I'm telling you. But some debaters thought then that it wouldn't be completely appropriate to compare apples and Doritos, for lack of better terms.
Well, I'm on the same boat as you, Aubrey. I actually also have a huge love for Doritos, as bad for you as they are. But anyway, in addition to the WHO guidelines, in the European Union, we also have some policy surrounding this food safety and assessment. The European Union and the International Life Sciences Institute, ILSI, created the Benefit Risk Analysis of Foods Program, or BRAFO. This is a good example of creating a common scale for a risk assessment framework.
The BRAFO program?
Yes, please explain.
So BRAFO was a 2010 European Commission project to develop a tiered methodology for assessing the benefits and risks of foods and food components.
Ah, okay, so it's more of a study than an applied framework.
You know, actually, this is starting to ring a bell now. I think in parallel, three groups of experts in natural foods, dietary interventions, and heat processing used this or applied this tiered approach to several case studies. Is that right, Dee?
Exactly. And afterwards, a consensus group reported on the implications of the experience gained during the development of the project, you know, to make further improvements. It's as if they applied the scientific method using conclusions to better inform the study and then proceeding further. You can actually read all through the case studies and everything, and we'll make sure to put a link up on our Facebook page and social media sites so you can access it there. Right, Aubrey?
Yeah, totally not a problem.
The debaters and Dr. Seckel agreed that this is a super important approach to understanding both health benefits and risks simultaneously. I mean, today's consumers take traditional food safety for granted in terms of microbial contamination and heavy metals. Honestly, food safety is now the minimum expectation.
In other words, consumer demands now mandate that we effectively change the definition of food safety to include risk of chronic diseases, such as diabetes. It's really the apples and Doritos thing. This acknowledgement led to significant discussion amongst our debaters about the difficulty of communicating concepts such as perceived risk and real risk to the public.
And the difficulty in effectively communicating risk to vastly different stakeholders is exacerbated by the fact that scientists, industry reps, policymakers, and consumers all require different communication strategies.
In other words, Aubrey and I require vastly different ways of having something explained to us, given our different academic backgrounds. While Aubrey may have no problem understanding everything around chemical processes, you're going to need to use some major layman's terms if you want to explain the same concept to me. The need for different communication strategies could even be personalized to the individual. For example, I respond well to emotional themes.
I respond well to data and numbers.
And I respond well to cats.
Is Callie sitting on your keyboard right now?
When it comes to cats, numbers, and emotions, food consumption is a very personal and emotional experience, which makes imposing numeric risk assessments, such as a limitation of 1 in 10,000 consumers getting sick, a difficult task.
Right. Any suggested improvements to the food safety system are going to raise costs and require some, if not many, stakeholders to pay more at the farm or market level.
So, debaters agreed that a major scientific opportunity would be the development of low-cost technologies that can be applied in the field to quickly measure whether or not a variety of microbe types are present. These tools would obviously have to be highly accurate and highly sensitive. Technologies for microbial contamination ideally would need to detect up to 10 different organisms.
This sort of in-field testing, as opposed to shipping samples to labs, was celebrated by debaters as an approach that could be readily used in developing countries. There was consensus that despite the scientific and economic challenges of developing such a technology, the approach should still be prioritized.
One specific illustration was the need for a handheld device that, for $10 to $15, could test DNA and generate results within a day. A low cost for such testing is paramount, because the food industry is highly sensitive to cost increases. Although difficult, progress is being made and some technologies are purportedly not that far away.
There currently exists some international efforts with a focus on deployment in less affluent countries. New technologies are also being created to facilitate more frequent surveillance for contamination, and to improve our ability to detect different levels of contaminant exposure.
In terms of sampling frequency, the first thing Aubrey mentioned, I have a coincidence to mention. I think my cousins in Chile have been working the past few years on a startup that does exactly this. I'll have to ask them about it, and maybe we can come back to it in another episode.
What a small world. Well, in addition to technologies from the supplier side, debaters also suggested pursuing new technologies that attack the issue from the consumer side. And this is an interesting idea because it would require, or encourage, I suppose, the consumers to directly test or assess products themselves.
An example highlighted here was food packaging that changes color in response to salmonella contamination, what we in the chemistry biz might call a colorimetric assay.
These approaches may be particularly important for small-scale local growers and distributors who, with current methodologies and limited product distribution, may actually be selling produce that's contaminated above a maximum threshold. and this might currently go undetected because their product is not consumed by enough people to constitute an outbreak. For example, if the product exceeds the threshold of making 1 in 10,000 sick, but is only consumed by a small town of a couple thousand, the risk could actually go undetected.
Right, so this is just one more reason why communicating risk is super important. The issue is that effectively communicating and promoting risk-based frameworks is super difficult, and it's the responsibility of both scientists and policymakers.
This is where Dee's point about needing to understand emotional perceptions of risks actually comes into play. There's a gap that must be bridged between what is or isn't considered an acceptable risk. For instance, most people accept the risks associated with, I don't know, driving a car, but they're much more hesitant to accept risk introduced by the food supply.
A numerical value for acceptable risk is not an inherently compassionate position. However, for the framework to be supported, all stakeholders, including producers, consumers, and policymakers, must believe in an acceptable risk level, whatever that level is then determined to be.
Communicating in a cold-hearted or emotionless fashion may lead to a loss of credibility, especially when the public's desired risk exposure is achievable only through unreasonable economic burdens.
And just to touch on another theme we love here on the forum, it's also necessary to develop a consensus in which various scientific disciplines generate different interpretations of risk, and then they can be combined so that all parties agree. It honestly sounds like an ISGP conference to me. And for those of you who've never been to one, my favorite part of an ISGP conference is actually when all of the conference participants get together in these small groups of 10-ish and basically aren't allowed to leave until they figure out what they, representing all the stakeholders, actually agree upon. It's a pretty cool thing to watch, actually.
Agreed. And in the case of our topic today, these sorts of stakeholder groups would need to include toxicologists, nutritionists, public health experts, and food scientists. The clear challenge is developing analytics to arrive at a unified position that can inform food system policy.
Okay, so just to make sure we're all on the same page, we're looking to find quantitative targets that allow us to apply the best available technologies for modeling and monitoring hazards to effectively enhance food safety.
Right. It's a bit different than our emotions versus analytics episode because while that one spoke to how we perceive risk and its consequences, this episode is definitely exploring how much risk is actually appropriate to maintain safety. How much risk can we allow and where do we draw the line? That's what we're talking about here.
And to answer those questions, we turn to national agencies making the policies that are theoretically based on risk. For example, the Produce Safety Rule, PSR, that falls under FSMA, which, by the way, is an FDA thing, is intended to ensure food safety through science-based minimum standards for the safe growing, harvesting, packing, and holding of fruits and vegetables grown for human consumption. The final rule went into effect over 2 years ago on January 26, 2016.
These kinds of risk frameworks are super important on both national and regional legislative levels because they provide a common currency for implementing regulations and performing cost-benefit analyses.
For example, a risk framework can help determine if nations should invest more in produce safety or in the safety of baby food. It also has the potential to inform regulatory priorities, such as whether public health agencies should be more aggressively regulating vegetable farmers or hog farmers.
And for this, outreach and farming education efforts, like the agricultural extension programs at U.S. land-grant universities, are essential for disseminating methodologies that could be used to achieve numeric targets for foodborne illness risk.
Debaters agreed that quote-unquote blue ribbon panels of experts should be commissioned to interpret all existing scientific literature on a particular food safety-related topic and then draft strategic plans and policy recommendations accordingly.
But this approach alone is not sufficient to effectively advance either the scientific or public understanding of risk. Current U.S. policies are a combination of both regulatory mandates and voluntary compliance. Debaters urged that improvements in both approaches will be required in the future. For example, the USDA Good Agricultural Practices Program needs to continue to provide methods and educational tools to assist farmers, but it also needs to create stronger numerical targets for risks to public health.
But wait, weren't you so adamant about the fact that numbers-based risk frameworks are incompatible with small-scale producers and distributors?
Yes. But it was generally agreed that exemptions to regulate small-scale farms are appropriate, and in some cases are even a required compromise.
In any case, guys, expanding the use of a risk-based framework in monitoring the global food supply chain would surely be difficult. Because of current funding levels and practical concerns, only an extremely small percentage of food can be physically tested, and it's not likely that those limiting factors are going to be reduced in any significant way.
Yeah, but it's still important to focus on the benefits, such as the fact that further development of domestic or even international risk acceptance standards could inform more efficient inspection efforts and dramatically reduce the cost of bringing food into other countries.
All right, that's out of left field, but I'll bite. That is a benefit.
In the end, Dr. Steckel urged that the goal should not be zero risk tolerance for adverse incidents. It's impractical, it's unhelpful, and there are better ways. Namely, all the ways we've talked about today.
This actually relates to several projects I'm currently working on.
Of course it does. Why don't you close it out for us then?
All right, so like you mentioned, a little bit out of left field, but I think it's related. So if you're on the more hesitant side of the globalization debate, bear with me for a second because there's actually an opportunity here to strengthen global food trade. Many international producers cater to the mandated safety regulations of the US and the EU. Targeting an accepted level of risk allows for variety when it comes to methodologies used to achieve that level of risk, unlike mandating a singular approach. This framework also instills a sense of ownership in the process for food producers because they end up contributing their knowledge and expertise to the system. Therefore, the development and application of global sanitation standards based on risk could actually help to create fairness and equality between large and small markets and promote more productive international trade negotiations. I, for one, know that in the many trade negotiation consultations I've seen between countries, being able to compete with costly safety regulations is always a concern for smaller producers.
What do you think, Cleo? Worth it?
That was surprisingly relevant.
All right, now that you two are done pretending I'm not right here, let's wrap this up, shall we?
Yes, please. So today we discussed the flaws of having a zero-tolerance approach and instead proposed a risk assessment framework for ensuring food safety.
Cleo spoke of the injustices that small-scale farmers face in trying to compete with infeasible regulatory standards.
And Dee managed to pronounce everything correctly today.
Okay, so now it's time for all of you out there to join the conversation. As a consumer of food yourself, how do you feel about transitioning away from a zero-tolerance system? Does it make you squeamish? You can be totally honest with us. In fact, your comments could end up on a future-related episode of our show.
Ooh, I like that incentive. Next question, then. Do you think small-scale and large-scale farms should be subjected to different evaluation mechanisms?
Make sure to share your thoughts with us on Twitter at ISGP Forum or on Facebook at www.facebook.com/ISGP Forum.
As always, we thank you for joining us today, and we look forward to chatting with you next time, right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.